Welcome to Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. And for those of you who reached out yesterday during our very short and sweet drive, we want to say thank you. But if you didn't get a chance to make your donation and get your truffle order in, it's really not too late. You'll have until Thursday, February 5th. Just go online to prairiepublic.org and let us know how many boxes you want and where to send them. Today on Main Street, we begin with an important discussion. What is the rule of law in these uncertain times? This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and now it's time for our monthly segment, Philosophical Currents, where we explore the deeper questions behind the headlines. We're joined, of course, by our great friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life that you can hear right here on Prairie Public. Today, we're tackling a timely and fundamental question. What is the rule of law, and what does it mean in today's politically charged climate? Recent events, of course, in Minneapolis have brought this idea into sharp focus. Over the past few weeks, two Minneapolis residents were fatally shot by federal immigration agents during aggressive enforcement operations. Officials initially claimed that the shootings were justified, but video evidence later contradicted key points of those accounts, sparking public outrage and renewed calls for accountability. These incidents have led many to ask whether the rule of law is being upheld or undermined when those charged with enforcing the law appear to be beyond its bounds. The rule of law is often described with a simple phrase that no one is above the law. But what does that principle really entail, especially at a time of political polarization and declining trust in law enforcement and institutions? What should the rule of law mean for how government officials act and how justice is applied? And is that ideal being met today? Dr. Weinstein is here to help us unpack the philosophy behind the rule of law, its origins, its ethical implications, and how it applies to current events. And we'll look at where this idea comes from, what philosophers have to say about it, and how it should guide us when the stakes are this high. Dr. Weinstein, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. And this conversation feels more weighty than usual, I think.
I agree.
Both you and I feel, and all of our listeners, are at a level of alertness and concern and fatigue that I don't know if it's unique in all of the conversations that we've had, but it certainly feels up there. And the notion of the rule of law is so foundational that it actually hides the fact that the phrase itself is a little more complicated, because there are two different facets, both of which you talked about in your introduction, because there is the question of who is bound by the law? Is everyone bound by the same law? Is the leader of the country subject to law? But there's another question that we have to ask first, and it is more simply, what is the law and what makes a law work or what makes a law good? Because if we want to ask whether someone is subject to the law, we have to ask what the law is. And so I would start with the description that the rule of law means basically, there is a known law that is understandable, predictable, and applies equally to everybody. And what that description illustrates is that people are able to understand the criteria by which they are judged, are able to act accordingly, and they will be held by those criteria. So let's take an analogy for just a second. Some of us have had the experience, unfortunately, of living with violent alcoholics. And let's say your parent, you're a kid, and one of your parents is a violent alcoholic. You never know what they're going to be like when you wake up in the morning. You never know what they're going to be like when they walk in the door. You know that the second they take a drink, their behavior changes, because one of the odd things about alcoholism is it's you don't even have to be drunk. You just have to have connection with alcohol, and it creates a neurological reaction. And so you never know if the thing that you say or do is going to be received as good or bad, even if it's something that they want you to do. They tell you to answer the question. You try to answer the question. They yell at you for talking while they're talking. You wait until they stop talking to answer the question. They yell at you for not answering the question. This is what it looks like when there is no rule of law. This is what it feels like when citizens are subject to regulations that are unpredictable, unarticulated, and applied arbitrarily. And what that ends up being is everyone is on edge and subject to the whims of whoever happens to have the most power at any time. And when you're dealing with police, when you're dealing with a militarized force like ICE, when you're dealing with a massive government like the United States, you have no power. I want to add something, although I know this answer is on the long side. I want to emphasize that phrase, you have no power, because there's a wonderful passage in one of the essays that I have my students read in my philosophy of law class. And it's talking about why we require defense attorneys and why the state is willing to give free defense attorneys to the accused. And the answer, and the description goes like this. Imagine you are on trial for something and you walk into a courtroom and you are faced with the full power of the United States government. You are faced not only with the fear of the courtroom and not only with the fact that the prosecution has all of these resources and not only the fact that the judge and the bailiff and all of the other things are in alignment with the government, but you are facing every single lawyer and every single history and every single law and every single bit of the United States government is aimed at prosecuting you. And the only defense that you have is your lawyer. The only power of resistance you have is this one person. And that one person is supposed to equalize the playing field, which of course is very hard, if not impossible. And that only works if the law operates the way it should, and if the law is articulated, predictable, and applies to everybody equally.
What bothers me the most is what seemingly is the arbitrary application of law or laws, in that we see certain things, we've noticed certain things recently, certainly, and it seems like some law doesn't apply to them. Others, of course, it does. Can you take us way back? Where does this idea come from, this rule of law? It has to have some roots, maybe in the day back to ancient philosophy or so, that you can really give us a good baseline here to work with as we continue our discussion.
It's perfectly clear that the need for law is built into the human experience, that all human beings live in society and have to, and are subject to authority. But also, time passes, and we have to be able to plan for tomorrow. So if I am a hunter, if I'm an agricultural tribal member, and I am told that this plot is my plot of land, and I plant seeds, I have to know that 8 months down the road, next year, that these seeds will come to me, that I am supposed to water the same plot of land, tend to the same plot of land. We actually see a version of this in the discussion about the United States involvement in Venezuela. When Donald Trump overthrew the country and took control over the oil, he invited the oil companies to the White House to divvy up the spoils. And Exxon, a trillion-dollar multinational company, responds to him and says, we are not going to do this because we've invested in Venezuela before and it's too unstable and we can't predict the future. So we're going to lose the money and we're not going to take that risk. That's the exact same problem that I articulated before. It's an individual putting seeds in the ground, not knowing if there's going to be any positive consequence. It's a $1 trillion organization, not knowing if they're going to get their money's worth. We saw this also in the beginning when Donald Trump tried to sell licenses to drill for oil in Alaska. Companies didn't want to do that because they knew that it would be overturned by the next administration. So the need for law is tied into the need for predictability and the need to plan for life and the need, of course, to control large populations, especially when they're controlled by a small population. Now, our system of government is called the common law system of government. And we've inherited that from England. When the colonies became independent, we basically just absorbed the English system of law. And it's called the common law system because in Europe in medieval times, there were all of these different fiefdoms and all of these different kings and all of these different rules and regulations. And when that became centralized, when the English king insisted upon centralizing things, he found all of the laws that were that applied to everyone in common. And so the idea is you take the cultural practices and the laws that are spread out and you codify them in a central location, which is ultimately what we would call a constitution and then the laws. And so you get interesting things like in many states there is what's called a common law marriage, right? And the idea is that two people have been living together for so long that they are basically married. But in order for that to work, at least as I understand it, it's not that they have to live together for 6 years. It's that they have to live together and tell everyone that they are married for 6 years and that they have to act as if and portray themselves as if they are married. And then it becomes marriage in essence as part of the common law. So what we are seeing and what our tradition of law builds on is the fact that there were disparate practices and disparate laws and disparate ideas, and that when they became centralized, the authorities wanted to preserve the natural practices and the natural habits of all of these people and hold all these laws in common so that all people who are subject to them could be protected and punished in ways that they understood and that they could avoid.
During my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, we visit monthly on a topic that is current, and this philosophical current's topic is the rule of law and what does it mean in today's political charged climate. Jack, if we could, I want to turn directly to the events in Minneapolis. How do incidents that we see, that we feel, that we witness challenge our understanding of the rule of law?
There's the most obvious way, and then there's a way that I don't think people are talking enough about. The most obvious way is that there's a general sense among the population that people who are doing wrong will never be punished for it. And that we are celebrating the wrong people, we are funding the wrong people, we are giving power to the wrong people. And so people who aren't qualified to do a job are in fact doing a job that they're doing badly and killing people, abusing people, creating chaos and adding to the chaos when there are no rules of engagement, right? Even in military, even during war, there are rules of engagement. There are very specific codes of conduct that soldiers have to follow, that they can treat the enemy in some ways and not treat the enemy in other ways. They can listen to their commanders in some ways, but they can say no in other ways. There's a script, there are limits. There doesn't appear to be that in this instance. And so the people who have the power, the armored vehicles, the smoke bombs, the guns, they seem to be doing anything at their whim. And if you watch the videos, you'll see that they pick fights with people. They try to create an environment in which someone will react so that they can overreact. Now, separate from that, and this I think is really key to the idea of the rule of law, I think that the vast majority of Americans who are paying attention right now will no longer trust their local police. I think the vast number of people who are watching this are going to look at their neighborhood police officers and say, I don't know where you stand. I don't know what you're going to do with me. I don't know what's going to happen with the information I give you. And therefore, the people who I should trust and respect the most as agents of law actually become the people who I trust and respect the least. I don't know what's going to happen when this is broadcast, but I just saw a news story that said the chief of police, or the police commissioner, I guess, in Los Angeles said that they are not going to enforce the California law mandating that ICE carry ID and that they're not allowed to wear masks. Now, I didn't dive deep into it. Maybe it was a false story. Maybe it was a misstatement and it'll change. I don't know. I can't say that for sure. But that's an example of there's a law and the head of the Los Angeles police is saying, well, I just don't feel like following that law. I don't want to do it.
One of the things I'd like you to comment on for me and for our listeners is when Renee Good was shot immediately, the first thing that I saw about that was Kristi Noem, the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, telling me that this domestic terrorist was shot. And immediately, I had doubt. And I knew I had to see the video for myself. We've all seen the video now over and over again. But I looked at the video and I thought, this person in power just lied to me. Things were said about Alex Preddy were the same, that people in power, Kristi Noem being one, the former governor of the state of South Dakota, lied to me. Now, in the context of the rule of law and the rule of laws and the rule of order in our country, how can we move forward when those in power say one thing? January 6th is another example, regardless of whether you're on the left or the right. How can we move forward?
So let's go back to that image I gave you of the accused in a court of law being completely overwhelmed by the power of the state. One of the tools that we have to help equalize that power, to help protect that person, is the presumption of innocence. That the idea is a person is innocent as far as the government is concerned, as far as the court is concerned. A person is innocent until proven guilty, and it is the burden of proof on the prosecution to prove guilt. And if they can't prove guilt, then the person is acquitted. What we see in those comments is a complete abandonment of the presumption of innocence. And what we see is a corruption that contagious, infects any jury, because any jury and any judge is going to go into any trial related to this with all of that background. And so the question that I think—
Controlling the narrative, they
were.
That's
right. So part of what I would suspect you were reacting to on a philosophical level is your brain was asking, well, what's the difference between law and propaganda? Right? Law is supposed to protect us and pursue justice. It's supposed to follow a procedure. Our system of law, this is complicated, we can talk about it, but our system of law is procedural and adversarial. So truth is less important than following the process and everyone having equal representation. But that's a very sort of complicated thing. So you're asking, how can I distinguish between the law and the propaganda? And if the people in power are deciding within 60 seconds, this is the story, this is what we're going to tell people, then how can we have any faith in an investigation, in a trial, in anything along those lines? I just want you to imagine that you are accused of something, independent of whether you've done it or not. And you find out that the entire executive branch of the administration has coordinated a story and has publicly expressed that story within minutes before you could even gather your own thoughts, before you could get a lawyer, before you could talk to your friends. In these cases, the people were dead. But how do you feel about that? How do you feel about the fact that you are completely powerless and have no redress? And that's the other aspect of the law that's important. The law gives us the opportunity to argue back. The law gives us the opportunity to say, you've said this, you've claimed this, you've argued this. Here is my response, and here are the people who are going to help me respond. And we can see how important this is by thinking about how all the other presidents, other than Donald Trump, react to similar situations. They say, and President Obama was particularly good about this, they'd say, it's a terrible situation and I can't comment on it because if I comment on it, it is going to affect things. If I can't comment on it, the president of the United States is weighing in on an issue and therefore distorting it. The thing that I don't know if Donald Trump understands or doesn't understand, but my initial reaction to the presidency, independent of everything else, is that he never seemed to understand that everything he said, regardless of what it was or how benign it was, had a profound impact on the world, right? Ronald Reagan famously loved jelly beans. And when he said he loved jelly beans became incredibly popular. George Bush the First famously hated broccoli. And when he admitted that he didn't like broccoli, the broccoli manufacturers of the country freaked out because they thought it was going to destroy their markets. And his wife, Barbara, had to come out and say, I don't care what George says, he's going to eat his broccoli, just to save the situation. And so you have a situation in which anything anyone says in that office is so benign, even if it's benign, has a profound impact. You know, I will admit, and I've been saying this to people recently, I have always been of the opinion that this comment that the president is the head of the free world and the president of the United States is the most important person and most powerful person in society and that the world looks to America for this, that, and the other thing, I always looked at that with a certain kind of skepticism and rolling my eyes and whatever. And it turns out to be true. It turns out that when the presidency of the United States is a mess, the world falls apart. So regardless of whether you agree with Donald Trump's policies or not, and regardless of whether or not you believe that ICE is doing something important and valuable and necessary, the idea that they're doing it outside of the rule of law, in an unpredictable, arbitrary fashion, means that the system is so chaotic that it infects the rest of the world. And that's ultimately what the rule of law is for. It's for creating order out of chaos in a country, on a globe, with now more than 7 billion people, all of whom have their own interests, all of whom have their own desires, all of whom can be selfish at times. And we need a way to manage that. And that's what law does. And so you want laws to be, again, predictable, knowable, and applied equally. And you want to have a sense of the enforcement mechanisms of these are also fair and just.
That's the goal, Jack. That's what we want. And we're going to continue our discussion. And I'm going to ask you, the philosopher, are we living up to that? Have things changed recently, or do things ebb and flow, as you say, as chaos comes and goes over time? And we'll do that right after this news. Main Street continues today with our good friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. This is our monthly Philosophical Currents segment, and we are exploring the rule of law and what it means in today's politically charged climates. Jack, before the break, I teased that I would ask you whether you believe the rule of law is under strain today and whether through history that strain ebbs and flows. What do you think from a philosophy perspective of how healthy is the rule of law in the United States right now?
So I was listening to one of my favorite pieces of music earlier today. Otis Spann, a blues musician, he was the piano player for Muddy Waters. He has this song called The Moon Blues, and he's singing about watching America land on the moon and plant the flag on the moon, and he published this song in 1970. And he's talking about how proud he is of the country and how amazing it is that we've accomplished these things. And he says in this verse, I love my country, but my country doesn't love me. The response to this question depends entirely on your perspective and where you sit. Because certainly the overall structure of the United States has been pretty consistent and has had integrity, for lack of a better word, since the Civil War. And when we've added new states to the country, we've reorganized Congress appropriately. And for many in the middle class, the laws worked very well for lots of different groups. But there have always been groups of people who were not protected by the law. And there were always there have always been groups of people who felt unrepresented. Imagine what it's like to be victim of domestic violence, who is asked to come to court, reveal all of the shameful things that happened to you, right? You shouldn't be ashamed of it, but we are often ashamed of it. To be told that the solution, if you're successful, is that you get to leave your own house and your kids are going to get taken away because you're in an abusive environment. Does the law protect that person? So there have always been fissures. There have always been pockets. There have always been places where the law has not protected people in the way that they should. But
leads to my next question, the tension between the rule of law and moral justice is, I think, where you're heading.
Well, yes, but and absolutely, and we should talk about that, because this word justice is the word that political philosophers, that legal theorists use as an analog to the word good in morality, right? Legality and morality are different, right? Some things are legal and immoral, like, let's say, adultery, unless you're in the military. It's legal to cheat on your spouse, but it's not moral. Speeding is illegal, but it's moral given certain parameters, et cetera, right? So we have this distinction, and there's a huge discussion amongst the philosophers of law and jurisprudence theorists as to the relationship between morality and law. Should law be built on morality? Are they completely separate topics? That's, in fact, the foundation of my entire class on philosophy of law. But I want to quote a philosophical aphorism, which is, the perfect should not be the enemy of the good. And what that means is, we shouldn't condemn the good things that we have because they're not perfect. And we should recognize that progress and change and trial and error are absolutely necessary, because we're imperfect people in an unpredictable universe. And so despite the fact that there have always been fissures of and pockets of people and situations where the law didn't work very well, there has also been the majority of laws that have worked very well and that have protected our property lines, that have given us decent education, that have given us the right to defend ourselves when appropriate, but also, as there is in Minnesota, the duty to retreat when we have, you know, too much power for the situation. Most of our laws, in fact, work. And we know they work because we don't think about them. We know they work because we don't challenge them. And we know they work because we probably don't even know what they are, right? And so what we're seeing here, it, the rules that have been misapplied to other people are suddenly being applied to people who never had to experience that misapplication in the first place. And what I mean by that is following, and I'm gonna use a phrase, I don't particularly like the phrase, and people are gonna react to it, but I think it's useful here. My friend Heidi actually made this observation to me, and I think it's a smart one, which is, notice that the people in Minneapolis are almost predominantly white. And notice that the people in Minneapolis who are standing in front of the trucks and screaming and yelling at ICE are predominantly white because they feel protected by white privilege. They feel like they are going to be more secure. And the African Americans who live in Minneapolis, who went through the George Floyd riots and who were subject to tremendous, horrible experiences in response to the uprising, the protest, whatever you want to call it, they're not out there because they're expecting it to get horrible. They don't feel protected. And so part of what we're seeing is that a group of people who do not, who are not used to feeling threatened, are suddenly feeling threatened and standing up for it with the conviction that they are protected because they haven't experienced this violence before. And I want to be clear, I'm not diminishing their moral contribution. I think the things that people are doing in Minneapolis are wonderful and should be glorified. And frankly, I should be there myself. I think these people are standing up in the face of power and fear and risk, and I am not in any way, shape, or form minimizing what they are doing. But what I am saying is what we are witnessing is the eradication of the rule of law on the next level of society, the next class, the next group, the next region, whatever. Legal failure starts small and grows big. And we are at the point where the rule of law is disappearing on the federal level. And that's terrifying.
Jack, I wanted to wrap this up by asking you, and I think you just somewhat answered the question, but I want to put it out there specifically on what we should understand about the protests in Minneapolis demanding accountability. Are protesters here, and even in the George Floyd protests, are they defending the rule of law or are they challenging lawful authority? And how do you as a philosopher think about that balance? Because it seems to me it may be both.
It is both, and it's both because the lines are blurry. We want to make the distinction between protest and civil disobedience. Protest is expressing your voice, doing things while not breaking the law. So standing around, holding signs, shouting, chanting, marching, that's protest. It's perfectly legal and it's central to the American experience. Civil disobedience is intentionally breaking certain laws in order to call attention to those laws to change. And so you could argue that people who are standing in the street stopping traffic doing a minor form of civil disobedience because they're breaking the law. So, according to Congress, ICE has legal authority to be going down the street. The people who are standing in front of the armored vehicles and not letting them go down the street, they are, in a certain sense, challenging legal authority. They're doing so because the use of legal authority is both unjust and often engaged in an illegal way, right? So ICE has, by legislation, the authority to arrest aliens who they reasonably suspect to be in the country against the rules. I don't want to say illegally, because being in the country undocumented is a civil offense, and the punishment is a fine between $50 and $250. If you are forcibly removed from the country and then you come back, then it's a criminal offense and it's a felony. But if you are in the country illegally without having given false information or anything like that, it's a civil offense. And so people are being beaten. People are being grabbed out of the car for no reason other than suspicion, color of their skin, what have you, because ICE can't make a reasonable determination as to whether or not someone might be here illegally in a split second through a car window. So you have legal authority that is being engaged in illegally. And what you have are protesters who are doing things largely legally, who sometimes have to do things illegally to address the illegal use of legal authority, right? And so what that means is, if everyone were playing by the rules, this would look very differently. And civil disobedience in the service of justice is, many people argue, moral and necessary. People will disagree, of course. Here's what I would say. It would be much easier to do all of this legally and calmly if, instead of 50,000 people marching in Minneapolis, there were 3 million people marching in Minneapolis. They could sit there quietly, calmly. They could be reading a book or looking at their phone, and all of it would have to stop, because unless ICE were willing to roll over and kill 500 people, which I'd like to think they wouldn't do, then it comes to a stop. And this is how nonviolent revolutions happen. This is how the civil rights won many of its gains, that millions and millions and millions of people sat down or prayed, whatever. And there aren't enough people to nonviolently resist the horrendous violence. And here we have the contrast between the United States and Iran, which is really important. And I'll tell you about a conversation I had with my student, although I tend not to talk about specific things that my students say for obvious reasons. What we know about Iran is that there were these incredible protests that were largely peaceful, of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, and the Iranian government mowed them down and killed tens of thousands of people. The numbers are unclear, and there are at least reports now of the government going into hospitals and shooting doctors who helped the patients, right? And so I'm having a conversation with two students after my introduction to political philosophy class. And a student was asking about that and saying, you know, the National Guard, these are their neighbors, they know these people. And I respond, we'd like to think that in America, soldiers aren't going to open fire on innocent Americans who they know, who they grow up with, that they wouldn't kill innocent people. I'd like to think that. And the other student said, my father is in the military, and he would open fire. And I asked him why she thought, I asked her why she thought that. And she said, my father does what he's told, and my father has tremendous loyalty to the government. And I said, well, shouldn't he have loyalty to the Constitution and not the government? And she laughed and she said, yes, he should, but that's not how he thinks. If my father is any indication of how the military would react, he would shoot if he was ordered to do so. And for the three of us, because it was after class and the three of us were in a room by ourselves, that was so profoundly upsetting And it's upsetting for me to talk about it now. The idea that America would turn on itself and that people who should know better, who live next to their neighbors, would openly kill their neighbors without having a gun pointed at them. That's terrifying. But if history tells us anything, it tells us that it is unbelievably common for neighbor to kill neighbor, and that it is very, very easy for things to destabilize to that point. And that's why the conversation has to be about the rule of law before it's about, are they being violent? Is this peaceful? What did Fred do wrong? What did Sally do wrong? You know, where did the process go awry? We have to have those conversations. But the first conversation we have to have, and the conversation you and I are having, and the conversation that we're not having on a national level and that the administration doesn't appear to want to have, is, are our laws predictable, understandable, fair, and applied equally to all people? And only if you have that can you then claim one set of people is acting inappropriately. Because if the members of ICE don't just have qualified immunity, but absolute immunity, if they can do anything they want, then the question of reward and punishment disappears. And it's not just that everything they do is bad. Maybe they're doing good things. But if they're doing good things because they feel like it, because it's in their mood that day, because they happen to have a lot of caffeine, they're not acting as representatives of the government. They're not acting representatives of the people. And that's the last major point, which is, I mentioned the 3 million people that could go to Minneapolis and, you know, 13 million New Yorkers sitting together. All of this is complicated by the fact that we are a democracy. And regardless of who you voted for and regardless of what side you're on, the government is supposed to represent the people, and the government is supposed to act on the voice of the people. And the only way that can happen is if the government recognizes and follows the rule of law. The rule of law is the telephone wire, to use an outdated reference. The rule of law is the telephone wire between the people and the government. It's the thing that connects us so that we can say, when Donald Trump speaks, he is speaking with the voice of the people, of the demos, the people, in a democracy. Democracy is ruled by the people. And you look at Minneapolis and you look at other places, and it is very easy to believe that this is not ruled by the people at all, that this is ruled by something else, whatever that is. And maybe it's deceiving. Maybe this is what 85% of Americans want. I don't think that's the case. But if it is, it's not being done in a way that adequately represents what the role of law really is.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, thank you for guiding us through this very complex yet very timely topic. And it's in these politically charged moments here that the rule of law is tested, and we'll live to see whether it stands the safeguards against both tyranny and chaos. But as you are suggesting, only if people and institutions are willing to uphold it. Thank you for joining us on Main Street.
I'm always happy to be here, and I hope that we can look back at this conversation as a weird, overly dramatic blip that is a good archive of a moment, but does not describe our world as it actually is. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes
home, he's relaxed with pep. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative producing reliable electricity for 140 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM Choral Artist with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 3rd. A steam locomotive can burn through a massive amount of fuel in a short time. Wood-burning engines were fine for eastern railroads in heavily forested areas, but not practical on the Great Plains. It made more sense for those trains to burn coal, and burn coal they did. Depending on the size of the engine and its speed, a locomotive could burn as much as 800 pounds of coal per mile. The firemen had to constantly shovel coal into the firebox to keep the train moving. But a locomotive needed more than wood or coal. Since the engine ran on steam, it also consumed a large amount of water. A reliable water source was crucial to efficient railroad operations. A locomotive pulled a tender holding 20 to 25,000 gallons of water. Using about 150 gallons per mile, trains required frequent stops to refill. Railroads built depots at carefully planned distances. Besides serving passengers and freight, depots allowed trains to replenish coal and water at just the right intervals. Water tanks were located near the station next to the tracks, and the engineer carefully positioned the engine so a crew member could refill the tender while passengers and freight were picked up or dropped off. Timing was critical to keeping trains on schedule. On this date in 1916, the Grand Forks Daily Herald reported a serious problem facing railroads. Train traffic on six branch lines between Minot and Grand Forks had ground to a halt. Railroads had strategies for Great Plains winters, including snow removal equipment. But in the winter of 1916, the problem wasn't heavy snow. It was frozen water in the tanks. Some trains were stranded, and crews shoveled snow into the boilers to keep pipes from freezing. At stations, crews drained what water they could, then climbed into the tanks to chip out ice by hand. The newspaper assured readers trains would return to schedule as soon as the water problem was solved. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
The United States talks of using military force on Iran and also considers withdrawing American forces from Syria. They've been working to prevent a resurgence of ISIS. We'll look at the latest developments and the ripple effects on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, did you miss it? Prairie Public Short and Sweet Drive? Well, it went by in a jiffy. It was only one day long after all, so you had to be pretty quick to get your truffle orders in. And if you did get yours in on Monday, thank you so much for powering Prairie Public. You know, listener donations like yours are just about the sole way this radio station and online service for North Dakota is funded. Your truffle order will be in the mailboxes of your choosing before Valentine's Day. Again, thank you. But hey, if you didn't get your donation in during Short and Sweet, there is still a little bit of time to make your Valentine or Valentine's very happy. Just go to prairiepublic.org, set up your monthly donation, and tell us where to send those delicious cocoa truffles from the Kohl's fine pastry. But hurry, if you want February 14th to go well, you gotta get your truffle order in by February 5th. That's Thursday. Dakota Medical Foundation reminds listeners of Giving Hearts Day, February 12th, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Since 2008, donors have helped raise more than $226 million. Details at givingheartsday.org.
And that wraps up this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Prairie Plates will celebrate a hot dish champion as we visit with Justin Clark of Groswild at the Jasper Hotel. That's ahead tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.